When Russian troops rolled across the border into Ukraine in February 2022, they were met with a level of resistance that the Kremlin had not anticipated. The Ukrainian army fought back, and so did civilians. Tens of thousands of Ukrainians joined the country's territorial defense forces. In Kherson, the first major city to come under Russian occupation, residents took to the streets in protest, and footage of ordinary people blocking tanks and confronting Russian soldiers went viral. These acts of defiance made headlines around the world, but openly resisting Russian occupation quickly became extremely dangerous. To stamp out Ukrainian dissent, occupying forces carried out atrocities against civilians, subjecting them to internment, torture, and extrajudicial killings. 4 years later, Russia's occupation regime has blended this brutality with bureaucracy, consolidating control over Ukrainian territories through relentless surveillance, coercion, and repressive measures. But just as Ukraine's army is still fighting back, the resistance is too. Only now, they've gone even deeper underground. Welcome to the Naked Pravda. Hello, and welcome back to The Naked Pravda. I'm Eilish Hart, the deputy editor of Medusa in English. For today's show, I'm bringing you an in-depth discussion about Ukrainian resistance to Russian occupation with Jade McGlynn, the head of the Ukraine and Russia program at the Center for Statecraft and National Security at King's College London. Earlier this month, Dr. McGlynn published her second report on resistance in occupied Ukraine for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Titled Thresholds of Survival, it follows up on her research into the diverse forms of defiance that emerged in occupied areas after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and analyzes how resistance has evolved in tandem with the consolidation of the occupation regime. Dr. McGlynn has documented a range of resistance efforts, from private, non-violent acts aimed at preserving Ukrainian identity to covert intelligence work that enables Kyiv's military operations, and even higher-risk actions, like sabotage and assassinations. Her latest analysis draws on field research to examine developments in 2024 and 2025, when, as she puts it, the resistance had to evolve to survive. To start our conversation, I asked her to take us back to 2022. I'd like to start by giving listeners some context about what resistance means, particularly in the newly occupied territories, so those that Russia seized beginning in 2022. I remember at the start of the full-scale invasion, there was very open defiance in some areas. We saw Ukrainians protesting occupation in city centers or even confronting Russian soldiers and blocking tanks. So what did resistance look like at the start of the full-scale war? And how long did these public displays of defiance last?
So at the start of the full-scale invasion, if we're talking about the territories that were occupied after 2022, you're quite right, of course. I think we all remember those images from Kherson. There were also kind of public demonstrations of resistance in Melitopol and other places. That type of public display did not last very long. People were quite soon, you know, sort of within days, within weeks, depended somewhat on the locality, sort of rounded up or advised to stop doing that in quite strong terms. There were still some forms of what I do describe in the report as public, visible, kind of non-violent resistance across 2022, in particular sort of people sending photographs of themselves, elements like this. It did differ a little bit depending on where you were. For example, in my own research, it does seem that the occupation was a little bit more haphazard in parts of occupied Kharkiv region, certainly than it was in Mariupol, where once they had taken the city after the siege, you know, there was a brutal filtration process. So again, we see an uneven occupation in terms of certain measures. And often, for example, in occupied parts of Kharkiv region, it could sometimes be somewhat random. So there is a pastor from Balaklia, a Baptist pastor, and Balaklia is in Kharkiv region. It was occupied until September 2022. He was tortured for his faith because often Russians believe that Baptists are kind of, you know, American spies, CIA, etc. He was tortured for his faith. I mean, his hand still doesn't work properly, whereas in Izum, you know, a friend of this same pastor who's also a pastor in a Baptist church, but in Izyum, which is, you know, somewhat further towards the Donetsk border, he was able to continue providing humanitarian aid, traveling, even crossing certain checkpoints. So, you know, there's this element of it not being fully established. I think of also the Russians, you know, a lot depended on specifically which unit or which Russian soldiers were responsible for the occupation. And of course, over time, that became much more codified, much more unified, particularly with Sergei Kiryenko taking over more and more control.
Perhaps best known as the Kremlin's domestic policy czar, Sergei Kiryenko is the first deputy head of the Russian presidential administration. He handles the political aspects of Russia's war in Ukraine, essentially acting as Putin's main point man for the occupied territories.
So that was going to be my next question. How has resistance in these newly occupied territories evolved with or alongside the consolidation of Russia's occupation regime? What types of resistance patterns emerged in your research?
So this report is a follow-up from a first report, which was based more on 2022 and 2023, when some forms of sort of public defiance or visible, though of course it was still, you know, hidden and covert, were possible. In 2024 to 2025, essentially after the failed Ukrainian counteroffensive, we really see that this becomes increasingly not possible. I mean, in many places, it was always not really that possible or not advisable. But for example, sending photos of yourself saying, you know, my city in occupied Ukraine is Ukraine became what is possible to do. But of course, with the FSB's stranglehold over the occupied territories, with the fact that all of the networks are connected via SORM.
SORM is the acronym for Russia's System of Operative Investigative Activities, an interception interface used by the FSB and other law enforcement agencies to conduct targeted surveillance of telephone and internet communications.
So that means that intelligence services can in real time access unencrypted messages, and for encrypted messages, they can access, you know, the metadata, that all of these elements, so they can tell if you're using kind of a phone once every few weeks to send images. They have an idea. That said, Telegram is still probably the, for let's say civilians in the occupied territories who want to help the Ukrainian armed forces, that is still probably the safest method, just because if there are regular stop and search points or regular checkpoints, if you are found with Signal, for example, the encrypted messaging app on your phone, that is enough of a reason to be dragged off to the basement, the euphemism for torture. People are regularly disappeared. So there's 15,250 civilians who have been identified who are missing or have been located in one of what the UN has identified as 204 various kind of black sites and prisons across the occupied territories for people who have, you know, in the Russian view, committed extremism, terrorism. So, in our view, without wanting to speak to this for you, I would just be saying, you know, Crimea is Ukraine, or some kind of, you know, often rather bland, but in this case, very, very brave assertion. So that form of visible, private, but you know, with some sort of public element to it is very not safe. And we also have to bear in mind that, of course, 90% of resistance at this point is just sending intelligence. It's sending coordinates, it's sending human intelligence to the Ukrainian armed forces. Of course, that also carries incredible risks, but there's a slight difference in that the type of people who send coordinates about military bases are more likely to be aware that what they're engaging in is dangerous action, for obvious reasons. Second, it does also then have, you know, in many cases, a military kind of strategic even impact. Whereas, of course, if we look at, for example, the November 2025 nationalities policy that the Russian Federation released, we can see in there, down to the very bizarre and concrete metrics about, you know, the need to work with the populations of the occupied territories to ensure they have Russian civic identity, that all forms of Ukrainian identity are viewed as extremism, as terrorism, as separatism. And therefore, sending a photo of yourself, whilst it may seem in a Western mindset to be, you know, a safe and non-violent action, as I quote the sort of leader of the Mariupol resistance in the report, we can't really indulge in that fantasy, because the chances are that it will end up in violence for the person who sent that photo, unfortunately.
You mentioned in the report that women play an outsized role in resistance efforts. Could you talk a bit about how and why that is?
So the information in the report comes from a lot of time in the deoccupied territories, but also sort of embedded interviews. So it's very difficult for me to actively kind of quantify, you know, how many women. However, something that came up in many of the conversations was that, you know, women do play an outsized role. Why is that? First of all, women are more likely to be in administrative roles where they're face to face with the bureaucracy, have access to that sort of information. And second of all, they're under perhaps less scrutiny because, of course, you know, if you're a male of mobilization age, you're going to come under more scrutiny. So there are a couple of different reasons for that. But yes, based sort of this qualitative research based on the interviews, it would appear that it is middle-aged women who are propping up a lot of the resistance.
What is the relationship between resistance in the occupied territories and the work of Ukraine's intelligence services at this point? Like, is it correct to say that at the beginning of the full-scale invasion, resistance was more grassroots and spontaneous, and now it's becoming more organized and professionalized, or is this a mischaracterization?
I would say that's a mischaracterization. I think what happened is, again, talking about post-2022, certain lessons were learned. So, you know, the resistance operating concept, which is NATO's resistance doctrine, that's a publicly available document. Anybody can read that. I'm not sharing any kind of, you know, deep secrets there. If you read it, and it's a rather long document, you can see that there's a real focus on kind of formalized hierarchy and cell-based structures. That's very much the approach. If we look at Ukraine's kind of 2021 law on resistance, which set up Rokoporo, which literally means, you know, like resistance movement, essentially.
Rukoporu is a unit of Ukraine's special operations forces tasked with organizing, funding, and facilitating resistance efforts in Russian-occupied territories. This includes supporting activist and partisan groups, as well as conducting operations against Russian occupation forces.
And that approach of formalized cell structures did not last very long, because obviously the type of people who had been recruited to be these stay-behind cells, they were all patriotic people, you know, who'd been engaged in civil society, who'd been engaged in, you know, the Maidan Revolution, Revolution of Dignity, who'd been engaged perhaps even in the Orange Revolution. And so they also happened to be pretty much exactly the same people that Russia had on its list to, you know, knock on the houses, find them, disappear them or execute them or torture them. And so it was quite easy. Mariupol is the city where I have the most kind of knowledge, thanks to the Mariupol resistance movement, about what happened. But essentially they were rounded up very quickly, and luckily a number of them managed to escape, and heartbreakingly a number of them of course did not. So the stay behind cells didn't really work out, unfortunately. And so a new model that I write about, I think quite briefly in the report, just because it's, you know, it's not that type of report that's focused on sort of tactics, but the new model that tends to be used is the puzzle model. You know, where instead of a cell, you have like certain coordinators, and then each coordinator has their own agents. You wouldn't know another coordinator's agents, and those agents would not know each other. So it's quite, I mean, that in itself leads to problems. Of course, it's very difficult to have any kind of proper control. But to be honest with you, the occupied territories are such a repressive and horrific place for people who wish to, well, I mean, for people in general, I think, but particularly if you're inclined to help the Ukrainian armed forces, that you're not going to be doing some kind of huge, there might be random examples, but in general, you're not going to be doing these huge kind of strategic mastermind plans anyway. And it is better for people who are on the ground to work out what is feasible. I think the main deciding factor of any operation in the occupied territories that involves people on the ground has to be, is it safe? Is it feasible? Because, you know, people who are still willing, you know, so long after the occupation began, you know, especially if we're talking about the 2014 areas, who are still willing to take those risks on themselves, they clearly need to be treasured and their safety needs to be treasured. And I think that that's something that's appreciated now maybe more than it was at the start of the occupation.
How does the occupation regime differ in the areas of the Donbas region and Crimea that have been outside of Ukrainian control since 2014? Like, what does resistance look like in these places?
There are a lot of differences. So in general, I have, in my head at least, split the occupied territories into three areas, arguably four, like three and a half, So you have Crimea, which, of course, because it was annexed and then formally incorporated, illegally, but formally incorporated into the Russian Federation in 2014, it functions a lot more like Russia itself. And we see that, for example, with civilian detainees or political prisoners, except we don't call them political prisoners because that would imply that these people are Russian and not Ukrainian. If you are arrested, then you do tend to actually more quickly come into the court system and it's easier to find out about people, for example. Whereas if somebody is arrested, let's say, or disappeared or taken to the FSB in Mariupol, it's more likely that they will just then disappear for a certain amount of time and we may then find out about them again. Technically, none of the occupied territories are formally in a state of exception because obviously that requires, like in Russian law, that would require a kind of time-boundedness. But in practice, I think we can talk about the occupied territories, particularly excluding Crimea, as a state of exception, in the sense that you just don't have, like, not sure that we can talk about Russia's rule of law state either, but there are certain forms of legalism. You know, this, I guess in a way we're talking about gradations, but in the occupied territories, you don't even maybe have some of those things that still can work in certain circumstances in the Russian Federation, for example. The 2014 so-called Elena DNR areas, interestingly, because they were sort of run by gangsters for a long time and continue, and you know, these are people who still have some political sway, like Pushilin, for example.
Denis Pushilin is the Russian-installed head of the occupied Donetsk region, or, as it's known in Russia, the Donetsk People's Republic.
I would say that there, the economic marginalization is much higher, and it is still a brutally repressive place. I don't wish to in any way be dismissive, but I think we are talking about a place that is under far less scrutiny than, let's say, occupied Zaporizhia and occupied parts of Kherson region, where sometimes they make more efforts to avoid the real depths of economic marginalization that you might see in Donetsk. But the situation is far more kind of like a police state. And again, I always feel really awful kind of putting it this way, because you're really talking about something that's really, really bad versus something that's really, really, really bad. And so I do just want to stress that for listeners. I'm not saying anything necessarily positive about the DNR. Mariupol was the most interesting place because for a long time it was under the control, it was sort of DNRized. So it was, because it's part of Donetsk region, it was then made part of the DNR. And therefore, although it kind of demographically was much more similar, of course, to the other post-2022 occupied areas, it was maybe under somewhat less scrutiny in certain ways than occupied parts of Zaporizhia and Kherson, certainly after the initial kind of period of the mass killing of civilians and filtration. But with Sergei Kiryenko's victory in enforcing his control, and with the removal of Morgun, who used to be kind of in charge of the city, and his replacement with Koltsov.
Oleg Morgun served as the Russian-installed mayor of Mariupol from January 2023 until June 2025. He was then replaced by Anton Koltsov, a Russian politician who previously headed the occupation regime in Ukraine's Zaporizhia region.
He's a Kiryenko guy. That appears to have changed. It's interesting in some ways what you can find in the occupied territories as well in terms of what it tells you about elite infighting back into Moscow, because, you know, you see various senior officials who have business interests, who have mistresses, who, you know, have come into a great deal of wealth as mistresses of the Russian elite are wont to do. You know, around the occupied territories, you know, you can look at kind of the large concerns, for example, like the state grain enterprise down in occupied Zaporizhia. You can, you know, there's quite a lot that you can learn about Russian Federation infighting and Kremlin elites from the occupied territories as well. But of course, that then has an impact on what is possible. And I think, you know, I'm always very wary about looking into, you know, what do people think about in the occupied territories, because we've seen quite large population transfers, particularly, let's say, in Crimea, where, you know, between a third to a quarter of the population have arrived since 2014. We've also seen population transfers, not on that scale, but elsewhere. We have populations who are incredibly traumatized by the war. And I, in general, when people ask me, oh, you know, well, you know, do people, you know, feel more Russian or feel more Ukrainian then? I often think, well, they probably just feel, am I going to have any water today? Because I haven't had any water for the last 3 days. I think that's how I would feel. But I also think it would be incorrect to say that, you know, clearly people in the post-2022 areas, especially because, you know, most of the occupied areas of Zaporizhia and Kherson, they were, you know, Ukrainian-speaking areas, or that's the language that they put as their kind of home or native language, a majority there. They're less, in most parts, less Soviet nostalgic, which is often, you know, what is translated into pro-Russian views, if sort of simplified for Westerners. We are talking about populations with slightly different kind of political identities as well. I think that's fair to say, which of course is going to then have an impact on whether or not, or the amount of people who are willing to maybe share, send coordinates or take a risk for the Ukrainian armed forces.
Do you see an effort to sort of harmonize the occupation regime across all these different geographic areas? Like, should we look at the policies and the regime in place in Crimea, for example, as a model for what the Russian authorities are trying to achieve in more recently occupied territories? Like, is that kind of level of control and incorporation, or does it still feel very kind of piecemeal to you?
You definitely see that they're trying to unify it, although in some ways, again, I would say that with the exception of occupied parts of Kherson, which does much more follow the Crimean model, and we even see this in terms of where children are sent for kind of militarized youth camps, you know, that particularly early on in the occupation were often used as a kind of a way of then kidnapping the children. And of course, there are huge efforts now to try to get them back, led by Save Ukraine, but by many, many others and many brave people inside the Russian Federation and inside the occupied territories who helped to get them out. Their children from occupied Kherson tend to be sent to Crimea. Children from, for example, occupied Mariupol, Melitopol, tend to be sent to Volgograd. So it's just one example of how sometimes it really does depend which area we're talking about. So I wouldn't say Crimea is necessarily the model, although certainly many things about Crimea have been a model. If we look at, for example, like the takeover of communication systems and things like, you know, kind of more of the technical, like decoupling from Ukrainian networks and connecting into Russian networks. With the exception then of occupied Crimea, I would say we are seeing a process towards unification, obviously in kind of Kyrenko's typical micromanager technocratic style. But look, I think everybody kind of listening to this podcast knows enough about Russia to understand that incompetence and corruption are often the best things about Russia, because they provide the ways that you get around all of the kind of the actual horrible formality of it. And that's very much the case there too. Also, there are some big personalities. I mean, Bakhlitsky, who is the governor of occupied, the Gauleiter, the Ukrainians would say, but, you know, the Russian-imposed governor of occupied Zaporizhia, he essentially disobeyed Kremlin directives on a number of things over recent years, and for that reason has sort of been sidelined. But he's still not been removed. Pushilin also often, you know, you see his kind of fortunes come and go. So yes, they are Russian-imposed, and yes, in many cases, they're often quite, you know, some of the stuff they get up to is quite laughable. I think we'll all remember, you know, Soldol, like the governor of occupied Kherson, kind of standing with a massive flood water behind him, insisting that there was no flood. But they do still have, you know, the Russians are still interested at least in perpetuating the lie that, you know, people want them there, that they have some kind of form of legitimacy, which obviously, of course, they very much do not in any kind of understanding of the word. So there are these efforts towards unification. However, they're often hamstrung by Russian or occupation incompetence, by corruption, and by big personalities and elite infighting. I mean, one of the reasons for the difference, for example, between the post-2022 occupied territories, particularly occupied Zaporizhia, occupied Kherson, and the DNR, LNR kind of model of occupation, was just infighting between services. So the post-2022 areas, they were more connected to GRU and GRU networks, whereas for the DNR and LNR, it was much more connected to FSB networks and interests.
I might be getting to this question late in our conversation, but, you know, given the degree of surveillance and repressions in these occupied territories and the fact that there's still a war going on, this seems like a really difficult and dangerous subject to research. How do you approach conducting fieldwork on resistance, and is it getting more difficult for you to research this as the war goes on and the occupation consolidates?
I don't think it's dangerous for me. Obviously, the main thing I think about is that it's dangerous for the people there. And so that's my number one focus is I think that we do need to know about it. I mean, part of the reason why I became so interested in this is, you know, learning certain things, often actually through friends who were serving in the Ukrainian armed forces or, you know, and some of the things they did before occupation or, you know, I spent a lot of time in East Ukraine. I don't think it's the secret. And I just didn't understand why people weren't talking about it more because it seemed to me quite remarkable that these people were doing this form of resistance. And also, it seemed to me pretty important because, I mean, this is just the other side of the front line. So it can tell us a certain amount, not everything, but it can tell us a certain amount as well about Russian plans. And of course, it's a fascinating topic, I suppose, just purely from an academic point of view. I mean, the main thing is that I do not, if previously, let's say before 2022, I might have had people, you know, who I just knew who happened to be in Donetsk, etc. Certainly since I've begun publicly researching this, I now do not talk directly to anybody from the occupied territories because it would put them, you know, it just wouldn't be worth it. So, of course, that then impacts certain elements. But there are, to be honest with you, there's an incredible amount of information available, including, you know, videos from, like, official meetings in Mariupol. If you know where to look for it, it's there. It's, you know, often it's public. It's just that, to be honest, I think in general in the West, people aren't that interested. And I'm very sad to say that I think sometimes in Ukraine, people aren't that interested as well. Perhaps because it's a painful topic, more likely because they've already got enough on their plate. So, yes, it's difficult. You have to be careful. You have to be very careful. I think in some ways it's become easier just simply because, of course, you're speaking to people involved in certain structures and over time they come to trust you. They see that if you do speak publicly, you know, you speak about what you agreed to speak about, you know, what you told them you would rather than like revealing any kind of important secrets. Not that they share any secrets with me, and nor should they. But I'm more just interested, I suppose, in the human aspect of this story. And also, to be honest as well, and I appreciate this is going to be like a controversial point. I think that if Russia is able to kind of grind Ukraine down to a point where it has to accept a capitulatory deal, or it collapses, or, you know, essentially it ends up in some kind of damaged form where, as a state, where it then becomes controllable for Russia, I don't see the conditions inside the Russian Federation that mean that country is capable of living in peace. And so part of what I want to understand is what are the things that are wrong, for example, with the resistance operating concept, because God forbid, and I very much hope I'm wrong, you know, we might need to learn the lessons, the good things and the bad, you know, the good lessons and the bad lessons from Ukraine in order to be able to apply them to other European countries.
The front line in Ukraine is currently stabilized in some areas, very fluid in others, but we haven't seen any very big shifts in quite a long time in terms of like major Ukrainian counteroffensives or anything like that. Do you find that the situation on the battlefield impacts resistance inside the territories on the other side of the front lines?
The main motivation for people who are engaged in resistance in the occupied territories is hatred, to be honest. I did hear that in 22, 23, you know, people becoming demoralized, particularly, you know, even in early 24, you did see people who, of course, they had believed that liberation was coming. And then in 2024, it started to become clear that, you know, liberation is not imminent, unfortunately, to put it mildly. But I think most of the people who continue to engage and send coordinates now are people who are driven by just a real hatred of the occupier. And I think that's a different motivator to hope. Perhaps I couldn't say whether or not it's a more powerful one or not, because thankfully I've never been in a position where, you know, somebody has come to my home and done that. To be honest, if I base it on my time in East Ukraine, in Kharkiv and in Zaporizhia, obviously the non-occupied part, people don't really talk about the things that we talk about in the West. They don't really like follow it as closely, or they just ignore it because it just seems so not relevant. And also after a while, whatever happens, you know, America provides this, America doesn't provide that, Europe does this, Europe doesn't do that, they're still essentially on their own. Like, yeah, of course, the more help, the better, don't get me wrong, but they're still essentially on their own. They're still going to have to get on with it because Russia's still trying to conquer them. And they, you know, particularly in the east, people are far more aware of what happens under occupation. And they very much just don't want to live under occupation for pretty understandable reasons, given everything we're discussing. So I think there's just a different approach to news. I remember going after Donald Trump's re-election, I remember heading out to Kharkiv about 2 days afterwards, and it was great because nobody was talking about it. Everyone was talking about, you know, actual things that needed to be done. Like, okay, well, these guys, you know, they need to have like electronic warfare, like updated, or you're talking about really, I suppose, kind of like relevant, concrete on the ground things.
The United States has now been pushing for some kind of ceasefire deal for about a year. And from my perspective, at least, the Trump administration has held a lot of meetings, but made very little meaningful progress getting Russia to end its war against Ukraine. What is your sense of how these diplomatic efforts are perceived, you know, inside Ukraine?
I think based on my circles, which are obviously, you know, quite specific, more politically engaged types of people, of course, people feel utterly bemused by what's happening in the US. I think they feel pretty, and we saw this in President Zelensky's speech at Davos, just feel like Europeans are a bit pathetic, really, which in my personal view is very fair consideration with a few notable exceptions, mainly the Baltic states. And, you know, a big part of that, of course, is also self-interest. We did have some engagement between Russian and Ukrainian sides in the UAE a few days ago or last week. But in general, we're talking about talks rather than negotiations, because it's kind of the Europeans and the Ukrainians talking with the Americans, and then some of the Americans talk to the Russians. And then by the time the Europeans and the Ukrainians have agreed something with the Americans, Russia or Peskov just comes out. It's like, no, I don't think so. And I think it's very tiring for people. That's my impression psychologically. I mean, in general, I don't know many Ukrainians who, I actually don't think I know any who wouldn't completely like bite your hand off if there was a viable, like, trustworthy ceasefire on the table. People are exhausted. Ukraine is not a rich country. It's a country, of course, that has many kind of structural problems, you know, as well, that of course none of these things can really be dealt with properly during the war. Huge numbers of people are dead and injured. People are fully traumatized, particularly out in the east. People need a break. You know, this has been a full-scale war, and they're on their own, really. I mean, they have friends and they've had help, but they are on their own. Like, nobody is coming, you know, there's no kind of Superman coming to rescue them. But ultimately, the option is either keep on fighting or be conquered and live under occupation. And without any form of reasonable kind of security guarantee. And I don't see why Russia would believe in any form of deterrence. I mean, we have the coalition of the willing, of course, that people, you know, talk about, including my government here in the UK. And I'm sorry, but I don't believe that British or French troops would actively stop a Russian reinvasion of Ukraine. I very much doubt that the Russians believe that. And if they do, they're much sillier than I thought they were. There are no real security guarantees right now. And what worries me is that I increasingly think that actually we've got it all the wrong way around, and Ukraine is probably the only security guarantee that Europe has. I mean, we know America isn't coming, you know, in terms of, I suppose, how one would have thought about Article 5 previously. Nobody in Europe knows how to fight a war like this. I'm not convinced that most ministries of defense have been learning the right lessons from this war. I'm sure parts of them have, but not kind of at the speed or scale needed. And Ukraine is the only country that's actually willing and capable of fighting the Russians in a war like this. I think for all of our sakes in Europe, we should probably be doing a lot more to, even if you don't care about things, look, quite clearly I care deeply about Ukraine and I have a great fondness for the country. But even if you didn't care about Ukraine, I would suggest if you're European, it's very much in your interest that Ukraine does not fall and that you help them.
Thanks for listening, folks. That's this week's show. As always, check out Meduza's homepage for our reporting on Russia, Ukraine, and the surrounding region. Share this podcast with your friends and enemies, if you want. Write a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're tuning in. Until next time.